audience of thousands.
You admit we are your people. Then do you still follow our customs and worship our gods?
Here is the turning point, thought Nasuada. She could lie and claim she had abandoned the old ways. But if she did, the Vardan would lose Fadawar's tribes and other nomads besides once they heard of her statement.
We need them. We need everyone we can get if we're to have the slightest chance of toppling Galbatorix.
I do, she said.
Then I say you are unfit to lead the Vardan. And, as is my right, I challenge you to the trial of the Long Knives. If you are triumphant, we shall bow to you, and never again question your authority. But if you lose, then you shall step aside, and I shall take your place as head of the Vardan.
Nasuada noted the spark of glee that lit Fadawar's eyes.
This is what he wanted all along, she realized. He would have invoked the trial even if I had complied with his demands.
She said, Perhaps I am mistaken, but I thought it was tradition that whoever won assumed command of his rival's tribes as well as his own. Is that not so?
She almost laughed at the expression of dismay that flashed across Fadawar's face.
You didn't expect me to know that, did you?
It is.
I accept your challenge, then, with the understanding that should I win, your crown and scepter will be mine. Are we agreed?
Fadawar scowled and nodded.
We are.
He stabbed his scepter deep enough into the ground that it stood upright by itself, then grasped the first bangle on his left arm and began to work it down over his hand.
Wait, said Nasuada. Going to the table that filled the other side of the pavilion, she picked up a small brass bell and rang it twice. Paused, and then rang it four times. Only a moment or two passed before Ferica entered the tent. She cast a frank gaze at Nasuada's guests, then curtsied to the lot of them and said,
Yes, mistress.
Nasuada gave Fadawar a nod.
We may proceed.
Then she addressed her handmaid.
Help me out of my dress. I don't want to ruin it.
The older woman looked shocked by the request.
Here, ma'am? In front of these men?
Yes, here, and be quick about it, too. I shouldn't have to argue with my own servant. Nasuada was harsher than she meant to be, but her heart was racing, and her skin was incredibly, terribly sensitive. The soft linen of her undergarments seemed as abrasive as canvas. Patience and courtesy were beyond her now. All she could concentrate on was her upcoming ordeal. Nasuada stood motionless as Ferica picked and pulled at the laces to her dress, which extended from her shoulder blades to the base of her spine. When the cords were loose enough, Ferica lifted Nasuada's arms out of the sleeves, and the shell of bunched fabric dropped in a pile around Nasuada's feet, leaving her standing almost naked in her white chemise. She fought back a shiver as the four warriors examined her, feeling vulnerable beneath their covetous looks. Ignoring them, she stepped forward out of the dress, and Ferica snatched the garment out of the dirt. Across from Nasuada, Fadawar had been busy removing the bangles from his forearms, revealing the embroidered sleeves of his robes underneath. Finished, he lifted off his massive crown and handed it to one of his retainers. The sound of voices outside the pavilion delayed further progress. Marching through the entrance, a message boy, Jasha was his name, Nasuada remembered, planted himself a foot or two inside and proclaimed, King Orin of Surda, Jormunda of the Vardan, Triana of Duvrangar Gata, and Narko and Ramosewa of the Inner Pashuna tribe. Jasha very pointedly kept his eyes fixed on the ceiling while he spoke. Snapping about, Jasha departed, and the congregation he had announced entered, with Orin at the vanguard. The king saw Fadawar first, and greeted him, saying,
Ah, warlord! This is unexpected. I trust you and...
Astonishment suffused his youthful face as he beheld Nasawada.
"Why, Nasawada, what is the meaning of this?"
"I should like to know that as well," rumbled Jormungandr.
He gripped the hilt of his sword and glowered at anyone who dared stare at her too openly.
"I have summoned you here," she said, "to witness the trial of the long knives between Fadawa and myself, and to afterward speak the truth of the outcome to everyone who asks."
The two grey-haired tribesmen, Narko and Ramosewa, appeared alarmed by her revelation. They leaned close together and began to whisper. Triana crossed her arms, bearing the snake bracelet coiled around one slim wrist, but otherwise betrayed no reaction. Jormungandr swore and said,
"Have you taken leave of your senses, my lady? This is madness. You cannot—"
"I can, and I will."
"My lady, if you do, I—"
"Your concern is noted, but my decision is final, and I forbid anyone from interfering."
She could tell he longed to disobey her order, but as much as he wanted to shield her from harm, loyalty had ever been Jormungandr's predominant trait.
"But Nasawada," said King Orin, "this trial, is not it where—"
"It is."
"Blast it, then! Why don't you give up this mad venture? You would have to be addled to carry it out."
"I have already given my word to Fadawa."
The mood in the pavilion became even more somber. That she had given her word meant she could not rescind her promise without revealing herself to be an honorless oath-breaker that fair-minded men would have no choice but to curse and shun. Orin faltered for a moment, but he persisted with his questions.
"To what end? That is, if you should lose—"
"If I should lose, the Varden shall no longer answer to me, but to Fadawa."
Nasawada had expected a storm of protest. Instead, there came a silence, wherein the hot anger that animated King Orin's visage cooled and sharpened and acquired a brittle temper.
"I do not appreciate your choice to endanger our entire cause."
To Fadawa he said,
"Will you not be reasonable and release Nasawada from her obligation? I will reward you richly if you agree to abandon this ill-conceived ambition of yours."
"I am rich already," said Fadawa. "I have no need for your tin-tainted gold. No, nothing but the trial of the long knives can compensate me for the slander Nasawada has aimed at my people and me."
"Bear witness now," said Nasawada.
Orin clenched tight the folds of his robes, but he bowed and said,
I will bear witness."
From within their voluminous sleeves, Fadawa's four warriors produced small, hairy goat-hide drums. Squatting, they placed the drums between their knees and struck up a furious beat, pounding so fast their hands were sooty smudges in the air. The rough music obliterated all other sound, as well as the host of frantic thoughts that had been bedeviling Nasawada. Her heart felt as if it were keeping pace with the manic tempo that assaulted her ears. Without missing a single note, the oldest of Fadawa's men reached inside his vest and from there drew two long curved knives that he tossed toward the peak of the tent. Nasawada watched the knives tumble haft over blade, fascinated by the beauty of their motion. When it was close enough, she lifted her arm and caught her knife. The opal-studded hilt stung her palm. Fadawa successfully intercepted his weapon as well. He then grasped the left cuff of his garment and pushed the sleeve past his elbow. Nasawada kept her eyes fixed upon Fadawa's forearm as he did. His limb was thick and muscled, but she deemed that of no importance. Athletic gifts would not help him win their contest. What she looked for instead were the telltale ridges that, if they existed, would lie across the belly of his forearm. She observed five of them.
"Five," she thought. "So many."
Her confidence wavered as she contemplated the evidence of Fadua's fortitude. The only thing that kept her from losing her nerve altogether was Elva's prediction. The girl had said that in this, Nasawada would prevail.
Nasawada clung to the memory as if it were her only child. She said, "I can do this, so I must be able to outlast Fadua. I must be able to."
As he was the one who had issued the challenge, Fadua went first. He held his left arm straight out from his shoulder, palm upward, placed the blade of his knife against his forearm just below the crease of his elbow, and drew the mirror-polished edge across his flesh. His skin split like an overripe berry, blood welling from within the crimson crevice. He locked gazes with Nasawada. She smiled, and set her own knife against her arm.
The metal was as cold as ice.
Theirs was a test of wills to discover who could withstand the most cuts. The belief was that whoever aspired to become the chief of a tribe, or even a warlord, should be willing to endure more pain than anyone else for the sake of his or her people. Otherwise, how could the tribes trust their leaders to place the concerns of the community before their own selfish desires? It was Nasawada's opinion that the practice encouraged extremism, but she also understood the ability of the gesture to earn people's trust. Although the trial of the long knives was specific to the dark-skinned tribes, besting Fadua would solidify her standing among the Varden, and, she hoped, King Orin's followers. She offered a quick plea for strength to Gokukara, the praying mantis goddess, and then pulled on the knife. The sharpened steel slid through her skin so easily she struggled to avoid cutting too deeply. She shuddered at the sensation. She wanted to fling the knife away and clutch her wound and scream. She did none of those things. She kept her muscles slack. If she tensed, the process would hurt all the more. And she kept smiling, as slowly the blade mutilated her body. The cut ended after only 3 seconds. But in those seconds, her outraged flesh delivered 1,000 shrieking complaints, and each one nearly made her stop. As she lowered the knife, she noticed that while the tribesmen still beat upon their drums, she heard naught but the pounding of her pulse. Then Fadua slashed himself a second time. The cords in his neck stood in high relief, and his jugular vein bulged as if it would burst while the knife carved its bloody path. Nasawada saw it was her turn again. Knowing what to expect only increased her fear. Her instinct for self-preservation, an instinct that had served her well on all other occasions, warred against the commands she sent to her arm and hand. Desperate, she concentrated upon her desire to preserve the Varden and overthrow Galbatorix, the two causes to which she had devoted her entire being. In her mind, she saw her father and Jormunda and Aragorn and the people of the Varden, and she thought, "For them! I do this for them. I was born to serve, and this is my service." She made the incision. A moment later, Fadua opened up a third gash on his forearm, as did Nasawada on her own. The fourth cut followed soon thereafter, and the fifth. A strange lethargy overtook Nasawada. She was so very tired. And cold as well. It occurred to her then that tolerance of pain might not decide the trial, but rather who would faint first from loss of blood. Shifting streams of it ran across her wrist and down her fingers, splashing into the thick pool by her feet. A similar, if larger, puddle gathered around Fadua's boots. The row of gaping red slits on the warlord's arm reminded Nasawada of the gills of a fish. A thought that for some reason seemed incredibly funny to her. She had to bite her tongue to keep from giggling. With a howl, Fadua succeeded in completing his sixth cut.
Burst that, you feckless witch!
He shouted over the noise of the drums and dropped to one knee. She did. Fadawa trembled as he transferred his knife from his right hand to his left. Tradition dictated a maximum of 6 cuts per arm, else you risked severing the veins and tendons close to the wrist. As Nasuada imitated his movement, King Orin sprang between them and said,
Stop! I won't allow this to continue! You're going to kill yourselves!
He reached toward Nasuada, then jumped back as she stabbed at him.
Don't meddle,
she growled between her teeth. Now Fadua started on his right forearm, releasing a spray of blood from his rigid muscles.
He's clenching, she realized. She hoped the mistake would be enough to break him.
Nasawada could not help herself. She uttered a wordless cry when the knife parted her skin. The razor edge burned like a white-hot wire. Halfway through the cut, her traumatized left arm twitched. The knife swerved as a result, leaving her with a long, jagged laceration twice as deep as the others. Her breath stopped while she weathered the agony.
I can't go on, she thought. I can't. I can't. It's too much to bear. I'd rather die. Oh, please let it end.
It gave her some relief to indulge in those and other desperate complaints. But in the depths of her heart, she knew she would never give up. For the 8th time, Fadua positioned his blade above one of his forearms. And there he held it, the pale metal suspended a quarter of an inch away from his sable skin. He remained thus, as sweat dripped over his eyes, and his wounds shed ruby tears. It appeared as though his courage might have failed him. But then he snarled and with a quick yank sliced his arm. His hesitation bolstered Nasawada's flagging strength. A fierce exhilaration overtook her, transmuting her pain into an almost pleasurable sensation. She matched Fadua's effort. And then, spurred onward by her sudden, heedless disregard for her own well-being, brought the knife down again.
Best that, she whispered.
The prospect of having to make 2 cuts in a row, one to equal the number of Nasuadas and one to advance the contest, seemed to intimidate Fadua. He blinked, licked his lips, and adjusted his grip on his knife 3 times before he raised the weapon over his arm. His tongue darted out and moistened his lips again. A spasm distorted his left hand, and the knife dropped from his contorted fingers, burying itself upright in the ground. He picked it up. Underneath his robe, his chest rose and fell with frantic speed. Lifting the knife, he touched it to his arm. It promptly drew a small trickle of blood. Fadawa's jaw knotted and writhed, and then a shudder ran the length of his spine, and he doubled over, pressing his injured arms against his belly.
I submit, he said.
The drums stopped. The ensuing silence lasted for only an instant before King Orin, Jormunda, and everyone else filled the pavilion with their overlapping exclamations. Nasuada paid no attention to their remarks. Groping behind herself, she found her chair and sank into it. Eager to take the weight off her legs before they gave way beneath her. She strove to remain conscious as her vision dimmed and flickered. The last thing she wanted to do was pass out in front of the tribesmen. A gentle pressure on her shoulder alerted her to the fact that Ferica was standing next to her, holding a pile of bandages.
My lady, may I tend to you?
Asked Ferica. Her expression both concerned and hesitant, as if she were uncertain how Nasuada would react. Nasuada nodded her approval. As Ferica began to wind strips of linen around her arms, Narko and Ramosewa approached. They bowed, and Ramosewa said,
Never before has anyone endured so many cuts in the trial of the long knives. Both you and Fadawa proved your mettle. but you are undoubtedly the victor. We shall tell our people of your achievement, and they shall give you their fealty."
"Thank you," said Nasawada. She closed her eyes as the throbbing in her arms increased.
"My lady."
Around her, Nasawada heard a confused medley of sounds, which she made no effort to decipher, preferring instead to retreat deep inside herself, where her pain was no longer so immediate and menacing. She floated in the womb of a boundless black space, illuminated by formless blobs of ever-changing color. Her respite was interrupted by the voice of Triana, as the sorceress said, "Leave off what you're doing, handmaid, and remove those bandages so I can heal your mistress." Nasawada opened her eyes to see Jormunda, King Orin, and Triana standing over her. Fadoar and his men had departed the pavilion.
"No," said Nasawada.
The group looked at her with surprise, and then Jormunda said,
"Nasawada, your thoughts are clouded. The trial is over. You don't have to live with these cuts any longer. In any event, we have to stanch your bleeding."
"Ferica is doing that well enough as is. I shall have a healer stitch my wounds and make a poultice to reduce the swelling. And that is all."
"But why?"
"The trial of the long knives requires participants to allow their wounds to heal at their natural pace. Otherwise, we won't have experienced the full measure of pain the trial entails. If I violate the rule, Fadoar will be declared the victor. Will you at least allow me to alleviate your suffering?"
asked Triana. "I know several spells that can eliminate any amount of pain. If you had consulted me beforehand, I could have arranged it so that you could lop off an entire limb without the slightest discomfort."
Nasawada laughed and allowed her head to loll to the side, feeling rather giddy.
"My answer would have been the same then as it is now. Trickery is dishonorable. I had to win the trial without deceit, so no one can question my leadership in the future."
In a deadly soft tone, King Orin said, "But what if you had lost?"
"I could not lose. Even if it meant my death, I never would have allowed Fadoar to gain control of the Varden."
Grave, Orin studied her for a long while.
"I believe you. Only is the tribe's loyalty worth such a great sacrifice? You are not so common that we can easily replace you." "The tribe's loyalty, no. But this will have an effect far beyond the tribes, as you must know. It should help unify our forces, and that is a prize valuable enough for me to willingly brave a host of unpleasant deaths."
"Pray tell, what would the Varden have gained if you had died today? No benefit would exist then. Your legacy would be discouragement, chaos, and likely ruin." Whenever Nasawada drank wine, mead, and especially strong spirits, she became most cautious with her speech and motions, for even if she did not notice it at once, she knew the alcohol degraded her judgment and coordination, and she had no desire to behave inappropriately or to give others an advantage in their dealings with her. Pain-drunk as she was, she later realized she should have been as vigilant in her discussion with Orin as if she had imbibed 3 tankards of the dwarves' blackberry honey mead. If she had, her well-developed sense of courtesy would have prevented her from replying so.
"You worry like an old man, Orin. I had to do this, and it is done. 'Tis bootless to fret about it now. I took a risk, yes. But we cannot defeat Galbatorix unless we dance along the very cliff edge of disaster. You
are a king. You ought to understand that danger is the mantle a person assumes when he or she has the arrogance to decide the fates of other men.
I understand well enough, growled Orin. My family and I have defended Surda against the Empire's encroachment every day of our lives for generations, while the Varden merely hid in Farthendur and leached off Hrothgar's generosity. His robes swirled about him as he turned and stalked out of the pavilion.
That was badly handled, my lady, observed Jormungandr.
Nasuada winced as Ferica tugged on her bandages. I know, she gasped. I'll mend his broken pride tomorrow.
Winged Tidings. A gap appeared then in Nasuada's memories. An absence of sensory information so complete, she only became aware of the missing time when it dawned upon her that Jormungandr was shaking her shoulder and saying something loudly. It took her several moments to decipher the sounds coming out of his mouth, and then she heard,
"Keep looking at me, blast it! That's the thing! Don't go to sleep again! You won't wake up again if you do!"
"You can let go of me, Jormungandr," she said,
and mustered a weak smile.
"I'm all right now."
"And my uncle Unset was an elf."
"Wasn't he?"
"Bah, you are the same as your father, always ignoring caution when it comes to your own safety. The tribes can rot in their bloody old customs for all I care. Let a healer at you. You're in no condition to make decisions."
"That's why I waited until it was evening. See, the sun is almost down. I can rest tonight, and tomorrow I will be able to deal with the affairs that require my attention."
Ferica appeared from the side and hovered over Nasuada.
"Oh, ma'am, you gave us quite a fright there."
"Still are, as a matter of fact," muttered Jormungandr.
"Well, I'm better now."
Nasuada pushed herself upright in the chair, ignoring the heat from her forearms.
"You can both go. I shall be fine. Jormungandr, send word to Fadawa that he may remain chief of his own tribe, so long as he swears loyalty to me as his warlord. He is too skilled a leader to waste. And Ferica, on your way back to your tent, please inform Angela the herbalist that I require her services. She agreed to mix some tonics and poultices for me."
"I won't leave you alone in this condition," declared Jormungandr.
Ferica nodded.
"Begging your pardon, my lady, but I agree with him. It's not safe."
Nasuada glanced toward the entrance to the pavilion to ensure none of the Nighthawks were close enough to overhear, and then dropped her voice into a low whisper.
"I shall not be alone."
Jormungandr's eyebrows shot up, and an alarmed expression crossed Ferica's face.
"I am never alone. Do you understand?"
"You have taken certain precautions, my lady?"
asked Jormungandr.
"I have."
Both her caretakers appeared uneasy with her assurance, and Jormungandr said,
"Nasuada, your safety is my responsibility. I need to know what additional protection you may have, and who exactly has access to your person."
"No," she said gently.
Seeing the hurt and indignation that appeared in Jormungandr's eyes, she continued,
"It's not that I doubt your loyalty, far from it. Only this I must have for myself. For the sake of my own peace of mind, I need to have a dagger no one else can see. A hidden weapon tucked up my sleeve, if you will. Consider it a flaw in my character, but do not torment yourself by imagining my choice is in any way a criticism of how you perform your duties."
"My lady,"
Jormungandr bowed, a formality he almost never used with her.
Nasawada lifted her hand, indicating her permission for them to leave, and Jormunda and Ferica hurried from the Red Pavilion. For a long minute, perhaps two, the only sound Nasawada heard was the harsh cry of gore crows circling above the Varden's encampment. Then from behind her there came a slight rustling, like that of a mouse nosing about for food. Turning her head, she saw Elva slip out of her hiding place, emerging between two panels of fabric into the main chamber of the pavilion. Nasawada studied her. The girl's unnatural growth had continued. When Nasawada first met her but a short while ago, Elva had appeared between 3 and 4 years old. Now she looked closer to 6. Her plain dress was black, with a few folds of purple around the neck and shoulders. Her long, straight hair was even darker, a liquid void that flowed down to the small of her back. Her sharp-angled face was bone-white, for she rarely ventured outside. The dragon mark on her brow was silver, and her eyes, her violet eyes, contained a jaded, cynical air, the result of Aragorn's blessing that was a curse, for it forced her to both endure other people's pain and also try to prevent it. The recent battle had almost killed her, what with the combined agony of thousands beating upon her mind. Even though one of Duvrangar Gata had placed her in an artificial slumber for the duration of the fighting, in an attempt to protect her, only recently had the girl begun to speak and take interest in her surroundings again. She wiped her rosebud mouth with the back of her hand, and Nasawada asked, "Were you ill?"
Elva shrugged. "The pain I'm used to, but it never gets any easier to resist Aragorn's spell. I am hard to impress, Nasawada, but you are a strong woman to withstand so many cuts."
Even though Nasawada had heard it many times, Elva's voice still inspired a thrill of alarm in her, for it was the bitter, mocking voice of a world-weary adult, not that of a child. She struggled to ignore it as she responded, "You are stronger. I did not have to suffer through Fadawar's pain as well. Thank you for staying with me. I know what it must have cost you, and I'm grateful."
"Grateful? Ha! There's an empty word for me, Lady Nightstalker."
Elva's small lips twisted in a misshapen smile. "Have you anything to eat? I'm famished." "Ferica left some bread and wine behind those scrolls," said Nasawada, pointing across the pavilion. She watched the girl make her way to the food and begin wolfing down the bread, cramming large chunks into her mouth.
"At least you won't have to live like this for much longer. As soon as Aragorn returns, he'll remove the spell."
"Perhaps."
After she had devoured half a loaf, Elva paused.
"I lied about the trial of the Long Knives."
"What do you mean?"
"I foresaw that you would lose, not win."
"What?"
"If I had allowed events to take their course, your nerve would have broken on the 7th cut, and Fadawar would be sitting where you are now. So I told you what you needed to hear in order to prevail."
A chill crept over Nasawada. If what Elva said was true, then she was in the witch child's debt more than ever. Still, she disliked being manipulated, even if it was for her own benefit.
"I see. It seems I must thank you once again."
Elva laughed then, a brittle sound. "And you hate every moment of it, don't you?" "No matter. You need not worry about offending me, Nasawada. We are useful to each other, no more."
Nasawada was relieved when one of the dwarves guarding the pavilion, the captain of that particular watch, banged his hammer against his shield and proclaimed,
"The herbalist Angela requests an audience with you, Lady Nightstalker."
"Granted,"
said Nasawada, raising her voice. Angela bustled into the pavilion, carrying several bags and baskets looped over her arms.
As always, her curly hair formed a stormy cloud around her face, which was pinched with concern. At her heels padded the weercat Solombum, in his animal form. He immediately angled toward Elva and began to rub against her legs, arching his back as he did. Depositing her luggage on the ground, Angela rolled her shoulders and said,
"Really? Between you and Aragon, I seem to spend most of my time among the Varden healing people too silly to realize they need to avoid getting chopped into tiny little pieces."
While she spoke, the short herbalist marched over to Nasuada and began unwinding the bandages around her right forearm. She clucked with disapproval.
"Normally, this is when the healer asks her patient how she is, and the patient lies through her teeth and says, 'Oh, not too bad.' And the healer says, 'Good, good. Be cheery and you'll make a fine recovery.' I think it's obvious, however, you're not about to start running around and leading charges against the Empire. Far from it." "I will recover, won't I?" asked Nasuada.
"You would, if I could use magic to seal up these wounds. Since I can't, it's a bit harder to tell. You'll have to muddle along like most people do and hope none of these cuts gets infected."
She paused in her work and gazed directly at Nasuada.
"You do realize these will scar?" "It will be what it will be."
"True enough."
Nasuada stifled a groan and gazed upward as Angela stitched each of her wounds and then covered them with a thick, wet mat of pulped plants. Out of the corner of her eye she saw Solombum jump onto the table and sit next to Elva. Extending a large, shaggy paw, the weercat hooked a piece of bread off Elva's plate and nibbled on the morsel, his white fangs flashing. The black tassels on his oversized ears quivered as he swiveled his ears from side to side, listening to metal-clad warriors walking past the Red Pavilion.
"Barzul," muttered Angela. "Only men would think of cutting themselves to determine who the pack leader is. Idiots."
It hurt to laugh, but Nasuada could not help herself.
"Indeed," she said,
after her fit subsided. Just as Angela finished retying the last strip of cloth around Nasuada's arms, the dwarf captain outside the pavilion shouted, "Halt!" And there came a chorus of shimmering bell-like notes as the human guards crossed their swords, barring the way to whoever sought entrance. Without pausing to think, Nasuada drew the 4-inch knife from the sheath sewn within the bodice of her chemise. It was difficult for her to grasp the hilt as her fingers felt thick and clumsy, and the muscles in her arm were slow to respond. It was as if the limb had fallen asleep, save for the sharp, burning lines scribed into her flesh. Angela also pulled a dagger from somewhere in her clothes, and she placed herself before Nasuada and muttered a line of the ancient language. Leaping to the ground, Solombum crouched next to Angela. His fur stood on end, making him appear larger than most dogs. He growled low in his throat. Elva continued eating, seemingly unperturbed by the commotion. She examined the morsel of bread she was holding between her thumb and index finger as one might inspect a strange species of insect, and then dipped it into a goblet of wine and popped the bread into her mouth.
"My lady!" shouted a man. "Aragon and Saphira fast approach from the northeast."
Nasuada sheathed her knife. Pushing herself out of her chair, she said to Angela, "Help me dress." Angela held the garment open in front of Nasuada, who stepped into it. Then Angela gently guided Nasuada's arms into the sleeves, and when they were in place, set about lacing up the back of the dress. Elva joined her. Together they soon had Nasuada properly attired. Nasuada surveyed her arms and saw no trace of her bandages.
"Should I hide or reveal my injuries?" she asked.
"That depends," said Angela. "Do you think showing them will increase your standing, or encourage your enemies because they assume you are weak and vulnerable?
The question is actually a rather philosophical one, predicated on whether, when looking at a man who has lost a big toe, you say, "Oh, he's a cripple," or, "Oh, he was smart or strong or lucky enough to escape worse injury." You make the strangest comparisons. Thank you. The trial of the long knives is a contest of strength, said Elva. That is well known among the Varden and Surdans. Are you proud of your strength, Nasuada?
Cut off the sleeves, said Nasuada. When they hesitated, she said, Go on, at the elbows. Don't mind the dress, I shall have it repaired later.
With a few deft movements, Angela removed the sections Nasuada had identified and dropped the excess fabric on the table. Nasuada lifted her chin.
Elva, if you sense I am about to faint, please tell Angela and have her catch me. Shall we, then?
The three of them gathered into a tight formation with Nasuada at the lead. Solombum walked alone. As they exited the Red Pavilion, the dwarf captain barked,
Stations!
And the six present members of the Nighthawks ranged themselves around Nasuada's group. The humans and dwarves fore and aft, and the hulking Kull, Urgles, who stood 8 feet and taller, on either side. Dusk spread its gold and purple wings over the Varden's encampment, lending a sense of mystery to the rows of canvas tents that extended beyond the limits of Nasuada's sight. Deepening shadows presaged the advent of night, and countless torches and watchfires already glowed pure and bright in the warm twilight. The sky was clear to the east. South, a long, low cloud of black smoke hid the horizon and the burning plains, which were a league and a half away. West, a line of beeches and aspens marked the path of the Jeet River, upon which floated the Dragon Wing, the ship Jode and Roran and the other villages from Carvajal had pirated. But Nasuada had eyes only for the north, and the glittering shape of Saphira descending thence. Light from the fading sun still illuminated her, cloaking her in a blue halo. She appeared like a cluster of stars falling from the heavens. The sight was so majestic, Nasuada stood transfixed for a moment, thankful she was fortunate enough to witness it.
They're safe, she thought,
and breathed a sigh of relief. The warrior who had brought word of Saphira's arrival, a thin man with a large, untrimmed beard, bowed and then pointed.
My lady, as you can see, I spoke the truth.
Yes, you did well. You must have exceedingly sharp eyes to have spotted Saphira earlier. What is your name?
Fletcher, son of Harden, my lady.
You have my thanks, Fletcher. You may return to your post now.
With another bow, the man trotted off toward the edge of the camp. Keeping her gaze fixed upon Saphira, Nasuada picked her way between the rows of tents, toward the large clearing set aside as a place for Saphira to land and take off. Her guards and companions accompanied her, but she paid them little heed, eager as she was to rendezvous with Aragorn and Saphira. She had spent much of the previous days worrying about them, both as the leader of the Varden and, somewhat to her surprise, as a friend. Saphira flew as fast as any hawk or falcon Nasuada had seen, but she was still a number of miles away from the camp, and it took her almost 10 minutes to traverse the remaining distance. In that time, a massive crowd of warriors gathered around the clearing, humans, dwarves, and even a contingent of grey-skinned Urgles led by Nar Garjvog, who spit at the men closest to them. Also in the congregation were King Orin and his courtiers, who positioned themselves opposite Nasuada. Narhim, the dwarf ambassador, who had assumed Oric's duties since Oric left for Farthendur, Jormundur, the other members of the Council of Elders, and Arya. The tall elf woman wove her way through the crowd toward Nasuada. Even with Saphira nigh upon them, men and women alike tore their gaze from the sky to watch Arya's progress. She presented such a striking image. Dressed all in black,
She wore leggings like a man, a sword on her hip, and a bow and quiver on her back. Her skin was the colour of light honey. Her face was as angular as a cat's, and she moved with a slinking, muscular grace that bespoke her skill with a blade, and also her supernatural strength. Her eccentric ensemble had always struck Nasuada as slightly indecent. It revealed so much of her form. But Nasuada had to admit that even if Arya donned a gown of rags, she would still appear more regal and dignified than any mortal-born noble. Halting before Nasuada, Arya gestured with one elegant finger at Nasuada's wounds.
As the poet Tiani said, to place yourself in harm's way for the sake of the people and the country you love is the finest thing one can do. I have known every leader of the Varden, and they were all mighty men and women, and none so much as Arjahad. In this, though, I believe you have surpassed even him. You honour me, Arya, but I fear that if I burn so brightly, too few shall remember my father as he deserves. The deeds of the children are a testament of the upbringing they received from their parents. Burn like the sun, Nasuada, for the brighter you burn, the more people there shall be who will respect Arjahad for teaching you how to bear the responsibilities of command at such a tender age.
Nasuada dipped her head, taking to heart Arya's advice. Then she smiled and said,
A tender age? I am a grown woman by our reckoning.
Amusement gleamed in Arya's green eyes.
True, but if we judge by years and not wisdom, no human would be considered an adult among my kind. Except for Galbatorix, that is.
And me?
Angela chimed in.
Come now, said Nasuada. You can't be much older than I am.
Ha! You're confusing appearances with age. You ought to have more sense than that after being around Arya so long.
Before Nasuada could ask just how old Angela really was, she felt a hard tug on the back of her dress. Looking around, she saw that it was Elva who had taken such a liberty, and that the girl was beckoning. Bending, Nasuada placed an ear close to Elva, who muttered,
Aragorn's not on Saphira.
Nasuada's chest tightened, restricting her breathing. She peered upward. Saphira circled directly over the camp, some thousands of feet high. Her huge, bat-like wings were black against the sky. Nasuada could see Saphira's underside and her talons white against the lapped scales of her belly, but nothing of whoever might be riding her.
How do you know? She asked, keeping her voice low. I cannot feel his discomfort nor his fears. Roran is there, and a woman I guess is Katrina. No one else.
Straightening, Nasuada clapped her hands and said, Jormunda! Allowing her voice to ring forth. Jormunda, who was almost a dozen yards away, came running, shoving aside those who got in his way. He was experienced enough to know when an emergency was at hand.
My lady.
Clear the field. Get everyone away from here before Saphira lands.
Including Orin and Nahim and Garshvog?
She grimaced.
No, but allow no one else to remain. Hurry!
As Jormunda began shouting orders, Arya and Angela converged upon Nasuada. They appeared as alarmed as she felt. Arya said,
Saphira would not be so calm if Aragorn was hurt or dead. Where is he then?
Demanded Nasuada.
What trouble has he gotten himself into now?
A raucous commotion filled the clearing as Jormunda and his men directed the onlookers back to their tents, laying about them with swagger sticks whenever the reluctant warriors lingered or protested. Several scuffles broke out, but the captains under Jormunda quickly overwhelmed the culprits, so as to prevent the violence from taking root and spreading. Fortunately, the Urgals, at the word of their war chief Garshvag, left without incident. Although Garshvag himself advanced toward Nasuada, as did King Orin and the dwarf Nahim.
Nasawada felt the ground tremble under her feet as the 8.5-foot-tall Urgal approached her. He lifted his bony chin, baring his throat as was the custom of his race, and said,
"What means this, Lady Nightstalker?"
The shape of his jaws and teeth, coupled with his accent, made it difficult for Nasawada to understand him.
"Yes, I'd bloody well like an explanation myself," said Orin.
His face was red.
"And I,"
said Nahim. It occurred to Nasawada as she regarded them that this was probably the first time in thousands of years that members of so many of the races of Alagasia had gathered together in peace. The only ones missing were the Razak and their mounts, and Nasawada knew no sane being would ever invite those foul creatures into their secret councils. She pointed at Saphira and said,
"She shall provide the answers you desire."
Just as the last stragglers quit the clearing, a torrent of air rushed across Nasawada as Saphira swooped to the ground, raking her wings to slow herself before alighting upon her rear legs. She dropped to all fours, and a dull boom resounded across the camp. Unbuckling themselves from her saddle, Roran and Katrina quickly dismounted. Striding forward, Nasawada examined Katrina. She was curious to see what kind of woman could inspire a man to undertake such extraordinary feats in order to rescue her. The young woman before her was strong-boned, with the pallid complexion of an invalid, a mane of copper hair, and a dress so torn and filthy it was impossible to determine what it might have looked like originally. In spite of the toll her captivity had taken, it was apparent to Nasawada that Katrina was attractive enough, but not what the bards would call a great beauty. However, she possessed a certain force of gaze and bearing that made Nasawada think that if Roran had been the one captured, Katrina would have been just as capable of rousing the villagers of Carvajal, getting them south to Surda, fighting in the Battle of the Burning Plains, and then continuing on to Helgrind, all for the sake of her beloved. Even when she noticed Garjvag, Katrina did not flinch or quail, but remained standing where she was, next to Roran. Roran bowed to Nasawada, and swiveling, also to King Orin.
"My lady," he said, his face grave. "Your Majesty, if I may, this is my betrothed, Katrina."
She curtsied to them both.
"Welcome to the Varden, Katrina," said Nasawada. "We have all heard your name here, on account of Roran's uncommon devotion. Songs of his love for you already spread across the land."
"You are most welcome," added Orin. "Most welcome indeed."
Nasawada noticed that the king had eyes only for Katrina, as did every man present, including the dwarves. And Nasawada was certain they would be recounting tales of Katrina's charms to their comrades in arms before the night was out. What Roran had done on her behalf elevated her far above ordinary women. It made her an object of mystery, fascination, and allure to the warriors. That anyone should sacrifice so much for another person meant, by reason of the price paid, that person must be unusually precious. Katrina blushed and smiled.
"Thank you," she said.
Along with her embarrassment at such attentions, a hint of pride coloured her expression, as if she knew how remarkable Roran was and delighted in having captured his heart. Of all the women in Alagasia, he was hers, and that was all the status or treasure she desired. A pang of loneliness shot through Nasawada.
"I wish I had what they have," she thought.
Her responsibilities prevented her from entertaining girlish dreams of romance and marriage, and certainly children, unless she were to arrange a marriage of convenience for the good of the Varden. She had often considered doing that with Orin, but her nerve always failed her. Still, she was content with her lot, and did not begrudge Katrina and Roran their happiness. Her cause was what she cared about. Defeating Galbatorix was far more important than something as trifling as marriage. Most everyone got married, but how many had the opportunity to oversee the birth of a new age?
I am not myself this evening, realized Nasuada. My wounds have set my thoughts a-humming like a nest of bees.
Shaking herself, she looked past Roran and Katrina to Saphira. Nasuada opened up the barriers she usually maintained around her mind so she might hear what Saphira had to say, and then asked,
Where is he?
With the dry rustle of scales sliding over scales, Saphira crept forward and lowered her neck so her head was directly in front of Nasuada, Arya, and Angela. The dragon's left eye sparkled with blue fire. She sniffed twice, and her crimson tongue darted out of her mouth. Hot, moist breath ruffled the lace collar on Nasawada's dress. Nasawada swallowed as Saphira's consciousness brushed against her own. Saphira felt unlike any other being Nasawada had encountered, ancient, alien, and both ferocious and gentle. That, along with Saphira's imposing physical presence, always reminded Nasawada that if Saphira wanted to eat them, she could. It was impossible, Nasuada believed, to be complacent around a dragon.
I smell blood, said Saphira. Who has hurt you, Nasuada? Name them, and I shall tear them from neck to groin and bring you their heads for trophies.
There's no need for you to tear anyone apart. Not yet, at least. I wielded the knife myself. However, this is the wrong time to delve into the matter. Right now, all I care about is Aragorn's whereabouts.
Aragorn, said Saphira, decided to remain in the Empire.
For a few seconds, Nasuada was unable to move or think. Then a mounting sense of doom replaced her stunned denial of Saphira's revelation. The others reacted in various ways as well, from which Nasuada deduced Saphira had spoken to them all at once.
How could you allow him to stay? She asked.
Small tongues of fire rippled in Saphira's nostrils as she snorted.
Aragorn made his own choice. I could not stop him. He insists upon doing what he thinks is right, no matter the consequences for him or the rest of Alagazia. I could shake him like a hatchling, but I'm proud of him. Fear not, he can take care of himself. So far no misfortune has befallen him. I would know if he was hurt.
Arya spoke.
And why did he make this choice, Saphira?
It would be faster for me to show you, rather than explain with words. May I?
They all indicated their consent. A river of Saphira's memories poured into Nasuada. She saw black Hellgrind from above a layer of clouds, heard Aragorn, Roran, and Saphira discussing how best to attack, watched them discover the Razak's lair, and experienced Saphira's epic battle with the Leatherblucker. The procession of images fascinated Nasuada. She had been born in the Empire, but could remember nothing of it. This was the first time as an adult that she had looked upon anything besides the wild fringes of Galbatorix's holdings. Lastly came Aragorn and his confrontation with Saphira. Saphira attempted to hide it, but the anguish she felt over leaving Aragorn was still so raw and piercing, Nasuada had to dry her cheeks with the bandages on her forearms. However, the reasons Aragorn gave for staying, killing the last Razak and exploring the remainder of Hellgrind, were reasons Nasuada deemed inadequate. She frowned.
Aragorn may be rash, but he's certainly not foolish enough to endanger everything we seek to accomplish merely so he could visit a few caves and drain the last bitter dregs of his revenge. There must be another explanation.
She wondered whether she should press Saphira for the truth, but she knew Saphira would not withhold such information on a whim.
Perhaps she wants to discuss it in private, she thought.
blast it! Exclaimed King Orin. Aragorn could not have picked a worse time to set off on his own. What matters a single Razak when Galbatorix's entire army resides but a few miles from us? We have to get him back.
Angela laughed. She was knitting a sock using 5 bone needles, which clicked